Welcome to the Brink of Midnight podcast with John Brinkus. A Brink of Midnight moment is when one life chapter ends and another begins. And from that point forward, nothing is ever the same. The moments are endless, and on this podcast, we explore and dive deep into the Brink of Midnight moments that made a significant positive change on an individual or even the world. And now, here's your host, John Brinkus.
All right, it's great to be with you today, and I'm confident you're going to love today's podcast because there are some words of wisdom coming your way courtesy of Trent Dilfer. Now, Trent was one of the very first people I met in the sports industry, and he's had the most profound effect on me because of his eternal optimism. Now, his optimistic outlook didn't just come in a single instance. Over time, he's dealt with the ultimate highs to the ultimate lows, events that range from quarterbacking the Ravens to a Super Bowl victory to tragically losing his son Trevin when he was only 5 and a half. It takes a lot of courage to open up and bare your soul like Trent has, and we're all fortunate that Trent is a very brave man. So sit back, relax, you might want to have some tissues handy, but also be ready to smile. It's always darkest just before dawn, but in Trent's case, despite his crazy roller coaster ride, by the end of this show, you'll understand why his life is now pegged at high noon. Trent, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
This is awesome. I'm fired up. We've been talking about this for a while, and I'm jazzed to be doing this with you.
So here's what I want to put in perspective for everybody. You've had some really big brink of midnight moments in your life.
To say the least.
To say the least. And today, yeah. The day that we're recording this podcast, you had a little news.
Yeah, just a little bit. I lost my job. Got laid off by ESPN after 9 great years. Kind of knew it was coming for the last couple weeks. I kind of fit the profile of the people they needed to trim. I'm saddened. I loved Monday Night Football, and you know that. You've seen me out there. It's the closest thing to playing. I love being part of the pre- and post-game shows. I love the people I worked with over the years, from Stuart Scott, Steve Young, some of my dearest friends, Susie Colbert, Ray Lewis a couple years ago, and the new guys, Matt Hasselbeck, Charles Woodson, Randy Moss. I've just had an absolute blast. So I'm definitely sad about that. But also overwhelmingly filled with gratitude and appreciation. I think that's what hit me this morning when I got the official news was, man, what a great opportunity. I jumped out of football. I had no idea what to do because my career ended on a couple injuries. I was knocked out for 3 minutes in Candlestick my last year playing. Then that summer, I'm going to try to play again the next year, and I tear my Achilles, my other Achilles, and didn't really know what I was going to do. And TV gave me this great opportunity to stay in the game. Met a bunch of great people at ESPN, you being one of the first people I met. And just went on this cool ride of learning the business and being able to teach the game I love to the audience and be part of some incredible experiences. And I just think it was an awesome thing. And I understand. I get the business. I think athletes handle these types of things better because even Hall of Famers lose their jobs one day. And we're conditioned for this as athletes. And the way ESPN handled it was nothing but class. Kudos to John Skipper, the president of ESPN, Seth Markman, my boss, Stephanie Drewley, all the people that had to make these brutal decisions, handled my situation with nothing but class, and I wish nothing for the best for all of them.
Right. Now, what's interesting is that you, more than most people, are really well-equipped for what would be to an ordinary person gigantic news, you know, earth-shattering news. But put in perspective for me what it just means to get a job or lose a job.
Well, I mean, we're going to get into this. We got an hour, so we'll get into some deep stuff. And you know me, I'm really vulnerable. I'll talk about anything. Yep. I've had a lot of mountaintop experiences in my life and a lot of deep, deep, dark moments. So a job what I said to you off mic was I've had so many incredible people reach out to me that it's like they're so kind, but these text messages and phone calls are as if I have cancer or as if I've died. And it's just a job. And I think when your life has a lot of ebb and flows, and you have perspective, when you have faith, when you think positively, something like today is more of an opportunity than a setback.
Right.
Life is full of incredible opportunities, and I'm excited about the ones ahead of me. And I've kind of approached life like that for a long time now, and I've done pretty well having that approach.
So let's rewind and look at your life prior to professional football.
Yeah.
Let's look at sort of your childhood, your adolescence. In order to make it, you know, even at the high level collegiate football that you played, and ultimately in the NFL, you had to have something that happened to you, a brink of midnight moment in your youth, where you realized, you know what? I'm capable of great things.
Yeah, I had two great sets of parents. My parents got divorced when I was young. My stepdad, who to this day is one of the biggest influences in my life, became my second dad. I had a great relationship with my father until he died 7 years ago. So I had two really good households, and they had joint custody, so I bounced back and forth. And I had two very unique situations. One was very athletic centric, my mom and stepdad, and my dad and stepmom very worldly centric, and got a very good balance growing up. My dad always said that he helped me stay in touch with my feminine side because he had three daughters and me. You know what I mean? So I was around girls a lot, and I think, you know, just growing up and being a knucklehead and making dumb mistakes. I call them look at me mistakes because it seemed like every mistake I made was to try to get attention. But, you know, doing all those things, I do remember a pivotal moment. And I was in college. I'd gotten to Fresno State by chance. I was not a very good quarterback in high school. They took a chance on me, and I'd gotten hurt. And I'd kind of gone down a dark road in college a little bit, like a lot of freshmen do, making some knucklehead mistakes. And I call this my cottage cheese moment. And what I'll explain is, you know, in the old days, your ceilings had that white speckly stuff on them before the nice smooth stucco, and it kind of looked like cottage cheese. And I always say that, you know, when the moonlight shines through your window and all you can see is the cottage cheese on your ceiling because you can't sleep and your mind's playing tricks on you, and that's really when you get in touch with yourself. You're vulnerable. You self-evaluate. And I had one of those moments, and it was very clear what I learned. If you don't like the way things are going, change the way you do things.
Wow.
And I didn't like the way things were going. I didn't like kind of where I was at. I wasn't depressed. I wasn't miserable, but I just knew that I was made for more.
And there was a singular night when that happened.
I could describe my bedroom, the apartment I lived in to a T, and exactly what I was doing. And I started down the path making some radical changes in my life. Now, I had more of those cottage cheese moments in the next couple of years, but that one I remember vividly was the, hey, you know, I was a hypocrite. And I liked things that were good for me, not good for everybody. And I didn't like the decisions I was making and where it was taking me. So I made a decision, kind of drew a line in the sand and said I was going to be a different person from here on out. And it's obviously been a journey, and there's been setbacks in that process. But that was kind of the first brink of midnight moment that I had that really, you know, I'll tell you what else it did too. It made me aware that those moments are real in life and that we all have them, and you embrace them. When they happen, instead of being scared, you go, wow, something really cool is coming. Because I'm real with myself right now, and I know that if I listen and I'm aware and I'm present, then good things are on the back end of this. And that's kind of been the pattern of my life.
When you think about, regardless of the way that you look at the universe, regardless of the religious belief that someone may have, those thoughts that pop in your mind in that sort of brink of midnight time zone where it's late at night, mm-hmm. in between being awake and being asleep, do you ever think to yourself, where do they come from? Why did I think about it on that night?
Well, we're very uniquely created, obviously. And there's we all have that inner voice, right? And it's whether we listen to it or not. And I always try to explain to people, and I've tried to explain this to my kids, it really teaches you who you are. You know, there's so many people are walking around Earth right now and they don't know who they are because they haven't listened to that voice. And they haven't been real with themselves. They haven't been willing to go there. I think by circumstance, by pain, whatever draws you to that point where you're willing to listen to yourself, it starts teaching you about yourself. And the better you know yourself, the better you know your strengths and your weaknesses, you better know how to walk this journey. And again, I am a massive work in progress, but if anything, I am self-aware and have learned to try to gain a better understanding of who I am and how life has conditioned me and how my circumstances have made me think the way I think, and try to be a good listener, because there's so much in this world that if you just listen and take it in, also teach you about yourself.
What's interesting is when I was in college, you know, I went down sort of that road that a lot of college students do as well. And I was drinking way too much. And I sort of had that one incident that happened. And on that day, when I was still 20, 21 years old, I said, I'm never going to have a drink again. Yeah. And I was in college.
And you haven't, and you have, you've held to that commitment.
And that voice though, that goes off in your head where you're like, uh-oh, time to make a change. And it's very binary in nature. I was born and raised Catholic, and I firmly believe that there is not one right religion, but the way that I relate to the universe is that there is right, there is wrong, and you know deep inside when you're doing something good or bad.
Oh, no doubt. I don't think there's any doubt that we all have a moral compass that we know when you are doing something that is appropriate, that helps mankind, or something that tears away at the fabric of mankind. And, you know, I think we all battle those borders, I guess, right, as we learn. But again, to me, it goes back to kind of having an awareness. You know, there's an awareness that goes on regardless of your belief system, that there are just basic values that every person should adhere to.
So your first Brink of Midnight moment that really defined you was in college, and you decided and made the conscious choice to just make a change in your life, to do things differently, which is something that some people never learn.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next moment? Let's now go past college. You now you're going into the NFL. Is there another Brink of Midnight moment that happened that you feel like, you know what? This changed me.
Yeah, a series of learning experience, self-awareness moments, cottage cheese moments, Brink of Midnight moments. But the next seminal one would be in 1999. I just spent 6 years with the Buccaneers and gone on a roller coaster ride with them. Starting, we're the worst franchise in football, and I got there very proud of that group of John Lynch and Warren Sapp and Derek Brooks and Warwick Dunn and Mike Allstott and Dave Moore. You know, great group of Buccaneers that took us, you know, out of the dumpster and turned us into a playoff team. Eventually, that group went to a Super Bowl. I was not with them, but eventually, they went to a Super Bowl and won one. But that journey was hard. I mean, some real down years, and then a couple great years, and then I got hurt and wasn't playing great towards the end, and they decided not to re-sign me. So here's, you know, going through so much and really feeling like we're ready to turn the corner, go to the NFC Championship game in 99, and then become a free agent, and they decide not to. Actually, I had you know how these contracts work. I had a bonus that was due to me that if they didn't pay it, I'd become a free agent, yada, yada, yada. So they didn't pay the bonus, and I become a free agent. And I remember the day I found out. I was living in Tampa, obviously, at the time, and there's this lake out in the boonies, and I just drove my car out there, and I was just listening to some music and kind of, again, reflecting. And it was one of those moments that I realized that the game of football had become about me too much. And that instead of being bitter and find all the reasons why this was wrong, and that instead of being upset and angry, I decided that I was not going to get bitter. I was going to get better. And there's got to be some truth to why they decided not to sign me, why they didn't think I was good enough to take this team to the next level. And I decided I wanted to find out what that was. And a lot of it was I wasn't the type of teammate that you need to be as a quarterback to take your team to a championship. And it was, again, one of those Brink of Midnight moments where I said, you know what, from now on, I'm going to be the best teammate on the team for whatever team I ever play on. And it football became more about everybody else in that moment than about me. And I think I'd played the position now since high school through college, first round pick, 6 years in the NFL. And I think although I was a good teammate, not a great teammate, it was still about me. And I wanted to make it about everybody else. It's ironic that that offseason I signed with Baltimore. I become part of one of the greatest defenses of all time. We win a Super Bowl. And what I'm most proud of, and what I think my teammates in Baltimore will say you, was that I was my goal was to always be the best teammate, not necessarily be the best player, be the best teammate.
And in being that teammate, you had to put yourself second. You had to say what's best for the team. And as an athlete, that's a very difficult thing to do because it is sort of at your own expense.
Yeah. You have to be a learner. It's the biggest thing I gained that process is you have to learn. You can't get so caught up in your own world that you're not willing to learn what's going on around you. And when I went into training camp with the Ravens, I went in very aware again. Very open-minded, but most importantly, I want to learn who are these guys? Who is this team? Who is Ray Lewis? Who is Shannon Sharpe? Who are these guys? And how good can we be? And I started becoming a student of us. And that might be the best thing I did for that team was by becoming a student of us, I recognized early on how dang good we were. And they didn't know how good they were yet. They had just come off an 8-8 season. I just come off the NFC Championship team. So I knew what good looked like, and we were better than the 99 Tampa Bay team. So as I learned how good we were, I learned early on this was not going to be offensive-centric. This was not about putting up the most points. This was not about putting up numbers. That whoever played quarterback, and I was the backup at the time, this was about letting that defense become superstars. And this was about a group of a great mixture of young players and wily old vets that had been through had a lot of pelts on the wall, somehow coming together and becoming like-minded. And that never would have happened if I didn't take the time. If I would have gone into camp thinking, okay, how do I win the job? How do I, how do I make up for the mistakes I made in 6 years in Tampa? I never would have learned how good we were. And I learned very quickly in training camp. This team can be special. And then events took place over a course of weeks where I became the starting quarterback. And I played the position that way. I played the position to try to, and I made a ton of mistakes, but I tried to never put Ray and Tony and Peter and Rod and those guys in a bad situation. Because if they were put in good situations, it was going to be, and it proved out, I didn't know how we were going to lose.
Right. So let's take your development. You decide to just turn things around in college. When you're in the NFL, you decide, you know what? I've decided to turn my own habits around, but I need that to be infectious. I need it to not be about me. I need to spread the positive energy to my teammates.
Yeah.
What comes next in your life?
Well, interesting. Let's go back. What I learned that too is, and we hear, leadership is probably the most convoluted conversation going on right now, right? People have so many different definitions for leaders, and I'm not going to dive into that. But what I did learn was there's a lot of people that can go into any room and adjust their leadership to the climate of the room, right? There's very few thermostat leaders. Thermostat leaders walk into a room and it goes up to 80. And what happens when when you're able to be a thermostat leader? One, you have to be very secure with the message you're spreading. But two, it's that positive energy. All of a sudden, you start getting the most out of the people around you because they try to bring their level up to 80 degrees too instead of being comfortable at 72. And I've really tried to live the rest of my days that way. And I try to encourage people to, if you're going to lead, then be a thermostat leader. Don't be a thermometer leader. And I've seen the benefits of that. So I just wanted to touch base on that because that was a really valuable thing I learned there. Because I think forever I led, but I led based on what the comfortable leading technique was. And you got to be comfortable being uncomfortable. I tell these kids that I'm with all the time that the edge of uncomfortableness is where true learning begins. You don't really learn anything deep until you're willing to be uncomfortable.
Right. So that sort of takes us a good way through your professional life. And when we look at the brink of midnight moments that have happened in your life up to that point, a lot of them aren't buried in your personal life.
Mm-hmm.
We're recording this podcast on nearly the anniversary. We're one day shy of a very significant anniversary, the passing of your son, Trevin.
Yep.
that has got to be the biggest Brink of Midnight moment, not only in your life, but in anybody I've spoken to.
Yeah, it'd be 14 years tomorrow, actually. And when we knew he was going to die, I had a family that was with us that had gone through it a year before, and they were kind of mentoring us through it. And they said, you know, this pain is going to be so horrific. There's no words to explain it. And people are going to try to comfort you, and they're actually going to offend you. It's just people are gonna, their intentions will be right, but there's nothing to say. Know this, that with every year that passes after this, the pain isn't as deep. And actually the memories and the joy through the 5.5 years we did have them become richer. And that is so true. I'll start there. That is painful as it is. And I do get choked up, and I may in this podcast. I do really now look back on losing him and appreciate the 5.5 years we had with him instead of the 14 years we haven't had with him.
So for the sake of our audience who may not know the story.
All right.
Tell us the story, and as you look back, nearly 14 years. Yeah.
We were on a family vacation in Disneyland. At the time, we had our three, Maddie, who's our oldest, Trevin, who was the middle, I mean the second, Tori, the third, and then we just had Delaney. She was a baby. And we were doing the typical family Disney thing, and he got a virus. He got sick, and you could tell that it was a bad one. So we cut our trip short, and we drove back to Fresno, where we were living at the time. And for a couple of days, he's real listless. You know, one of those flus that, as a parent, you know, worries you, but you're not freaking out. Well, we decided to take him to the emergency room on, I don't know, second or third night back, and they pump him full of fluids and do some blood tests, and everything looks fine. He kind of comes back, and we're laughing with him in the hospital room, and he's alert. And but there were some numbers that were disturbing in the blood work, so they decided to send him to Children's Hospital in Fresno, which is an incredible hospital. Just, you know, to be looked at overnight and kind of dig into the numbers a little deeper. There was some possible hepatitis stuff, you know. So I take the other three back to the house, and my wife's going to ride in the ambulance with them, because you can only transport from hospital to hospital in an ambulance. And so they're going to the ambulance, and they're in the ambulance heading over, and I'm taking the kids back. And right as I get home, I get a call that says, you need to get to Children's Hospital. Your son is unconscious and his heart has stopped. And I mean, it's still surreal. It's still surreal thinking about it, but I, you know, drove across town, blew through every red light, got there. And the first visual I have is I walk into this room and my wife's wailing, and here are these two nurses manually pumping his heart. So it becomes a little, my wife and I tell the story a little different, because I think our details and our perspective is a little different, but his heart had stopped three times. And they had brought him back. And at one point they came out and said, you know, your son's dead.
That night.
Yeah, we were in lawn chairs outside this one room after hours of this going on. I could still see through the glass these they were manually pumping his heart to keep it going. And they were trying to get him on this unit that could just keep his heart going. And they couldn't keep him manually alive long enough to get him on the unit. And as they're telling us this, there's some noise and there's kind of a celebration, and they're able to get him going enough where they get the unit on him. So we go from he's dead to, wait a second, we got him on this life support system and now there's a chance. Well, this is right around when the war started in Iraq, and the only way you could transport somebody on this unit, it's called an ECMO unit, is by military helicopter, and they can only go to a couple hospitals, Stanford, Lucile Packard Children's, or Michigan at the time. Well, there's no of these transport helicopters available.
There's nothing.
Nothing. I have a dear, dear friend that to this day I owe my life, who is very connected in the hospital world, and he gets us into Lucile Packard and gets the people at Lucile Packard to talk to the people at Fresno Children's to take a chance and create the same environment out of an ambulance that they do in the helicopter. Never been done before. And sure enough, the next morning, they feel like they put the team together. They feel like they're able to get the unit into the ambulance, balance out the ambulance enough that it's 50-50. And they tell us going in, listen, we hit the wrong bump. If the wrong thing happens, if the wrong attachment comes, you know, he's not going to make it. It'll be a semi-miracle to make it to Stanford from Fresno. So imagine, and we can't ride with him. So we're in a Suburban. My best buddy, Brad Bell, at the time, who's a pastor now in Fresno, the Well Church, is driving us. And we're just sitting there watching the ambulance. And every bump you go over, you can just imagine. We don't know if he's making it or not. We make it. We get to Lewis Hill Packard. Again, just getting him out of the ambulance up to ICU is another challenge where they come out and they're fully honest. Listen, it's a miracle we've gotten this far. It's going to be a miracle if we get him up and transfer him over to, they have to put him on a whole new unit. So they got to take him off the one that he barely got on to start with and put him on a new one at Lewis Hill Packard. We get through that. He makes it. So now we set up Camp Trevin, is what they called it, at Lewis Hill Packard, where all of our closest friends and family from all over the country, football coach Clyde Christensen, who was my coach in Tampa, who's with the Colts coaching Peyton Manning at the time, takes 3 weeks out of the offseason, April, like draft time, comes out. And basically for 3 weeks, he strolled Delaney, our baby, around in a stroller, or they went and got meals, or we played cards or whatever. But basically we set up camp in Lewis Hill Packard Hospital, the Workman family, the Bell family, the Broussard family. I mean, go on and on about so many families just came and gave their lives up for us to be with us. And he was on a donor list. You know, he was on a heart donor list. And he also needed lung transplant also, but that was less, I guess, dramatic at the time. The heart was the big thing. And so you find yourself in the situation where you're praying for a heart for your son, but you know by getting that heart, because of his age, that's going to take the life of another young person. And you're in this horrific situation where, yes, you want a heart to come up for your son, but you can't imagine the pain of the other family that's going to have to lose somebody in order for our child to get that heart. So that's one of the things. He couldn't talk. His chest was flayed open from throat to belly button, wide open, all the machines on him. Obviously, infection is the biggest fear when they're in that environment. He couldn't communicate, but what they would do is they would take him off pain medication, lower the pain medication enough to where, yes, he was in pain, but he could hear. So, and he could squeeze our finger. So we were able to communicate him very rarely because we didn't want him to be in pain. But there were three or four instances where my wife and I would go in and sit with him and talk to him. And he was able to squeeze his finger. A tear would come out of his eye. Things like that. This is where it gets hard. But they're special moments, right? Because they're the last moments that we had with them. And we're able to, you know, the fun thing is we still have this dog. We have an English cream golden retriever named Rescue. And everybody goes, well, is it a rescue dog? I said, no, it's actually a great story. When we're in the hospital, one of these moments when we were asking him questions, like, hey, when you get out of here, buddy, what do you want? You know, and we would go all through his favorite things. And we said, do you want a dog? And he squeezed our finger. Oh. And, you know, do you want a golden retriever? Yeah, he squeezed.
Oh, my God.
And so we deduced from that experience that he wanted a white golden retriever. So we were mindset, you know, at that, we're researching golden retrievers and white golden retrievers. And, you know, they're English creams is what they're called. And to this day, we have Rescue, who is named after Trevin, because Trevin's superhero name was Trevin to the Rescue, because he'd always come to the rescue of his sisters, or he'd come to the rescue of a cat, or he'd come to the rescue of something. So he called himself Trevin to the Rescue. So he named our golden rescue. So anyhow, we go through this. We come out. He gets a systemic infection. A heart doesn't come up for 34 days. And part of us was devastated, and part of us was still like, well, that's good. That means no young child has died. And then they had warned us since day one, infections. That's the, you know, the longer he goes, the greater risk he is for infection. And sure enough, he got a systemic infection. And that's basically a death sentence, because now you're off the donor list. They're not going to put a good heart into a person that has a systemic infection. So we have a series of days to decide on the course. And I know this is a really controversial subject. I'll just tell you our perspective. Basically, it was explained to us that we can keep him alive for a pretty long period of time, basically with drugs. At some point, those drugs are going to wear off and he's going to be in a great deal of pain. He will die. There was 100% chance. There was no coming back. So just how long did we want him in this state? So we sought counsel from people over the country. We had great people speak into our lives. We prayed about it diligently. And 5 days later, we decided that the best course of action was to take him off life support. And my wife and I were there with him. And when we did it, it was 40 days in. And obviously the most horrific thing you can go through as a parent and as a family. I remember telling maybe the most painful thing was having to tell the girls. And Maddie especially, because Maddie, who is now 21, was 7. So she got it. And they were best buddies. And Tori was obviously in a lot of pain at the time. But she was so young, it was still, she, I don't know if she really understood what was going on. And then Delaney was obviously a baby. But telling Maddie was on the rooftop of Lucille Packard. Still one of those vivid memories that, as you can tell by me losing it, still brings a great deal of pain. So we can press the pause button there because I've been talking too long. I'd be more than happy to talk about the rest. So, but that's kind of how we lost him.
In that moment where Trevin passes, the pain has to be unimaginable. As a parent, myself, I can't possibly imagine.
The pain is worse for, as a father, at least, this is how I felt it. I went into protective mode. So my pain, my severe pain was feeling it for my wife, my girls.
You had to be a teammate.
You have to be a teammate. It can't be about you and your pain. And that's kind of why I told the story about Baltimore. Right. 'Cause there were a lot of lessons learned through football. That's why I don't want football to ever go away. People talk about the risks of it. The benefits far outweigh the risks because what I learned through my journey in football to that point carried me. Those principles carried me through something a million X more important than football, but the lessons, the principles are still the same.
So that brink of midnight moment happens. Trevin passes. You need to be the strength for the family. Yeah. You have to be the rock for your wife, for your kids. What did that burden feel like at the time?
So at first you rally, and this is really unique. And I went to counseling for a long time, and I probably need to go back to kind of figure out some of this stuff still to this day. But at first the rallying wasn't hard because for the reasons we're dad, we're husband, we're the man. I got to figure this out. I can't let my wife go in the tank. I can't let these girls' lives be ruined. Like, let's move forward. And how do you do that? So for a short period of time, you go into go mode. You know what I mean? It was like playing again. Like, it was like lifting weights again, where it doesn't matter how much they put on the rack, I'm going to get it up. It doesn't matter how much I hurt, I'm going to get the next rep. It doesn't matter how tired I am, I'm going to finish the sprint. You know, you just go through that resilience mode. You can't break me type thing. And that lasted for, I don't know, a couple weeks. And then it hit. And when it hit so hard. I mean, massive depression, for lack of a better term, just where I had nothing left. And actually, my wife was doing pretty good at the time because she had locked into, I got to be a parent to these three girls. So she was kind of locked into, and we deal very differently to this day. We have this great marriage because we're polar opposites, but we get it. So we let each other be opposites. She buries everything. She packs it in. She's not nearly as emotional as me. I'm a crybaby. I wear it on my sleeve. You know, we're just totally different. Well, those roles were different for the first 2 weeks. I was the strong one. I was unbearing it. She was emotional. Well, then she flips the switch. She goes into go mode. She's parenting. She's going about her day. She's dealing with everything. And I don't know how to be me again. And the emotion was too much. I was completely depressed. I mean, there were days. I'm a guy that when I wake up, I wake up and jump out of bed. And when I crash usually, right. You know.
You're on and off.
I'm on and off. There's nothing in between. Well, I was just milquetoast. I started getting fat. I'm not a big drinker. I was drinking heavily. Started off as a glass of wine at night to go to bed easy. Then it became two. Then became a bottle. Then became a bottle and a half because it would numb me. Sorry, I'm not a big TV watcher. Would watch TV till 2-3 in the morning. Stuff I don't even remember what I watched. Right. You know, so it just got really, really dark. Luckily, my wife was the rock in that period of time. Our friends, you know, our community was just amazing. And then really I'll finish here and then we can circle back wherever you want. I was supposed to go to training camp. Remember, I'm playing with the Seattle Seahawks. I was a starting quarterback the year before I tore my Achilles.
You're still in the league.
Yeah. And I actually had played some of the best football of my life the last 18 months before I tore my right Achilles, the game Emmitt Smith broke the rushing record in Dallas. So I might, you know, I still have millions of dollars of earning potential ahead of me and all my dreams still ahead of me. And I had never even thought about this stuff. And I get a call one night from Matt Hasselbeck, Matthew. And I don't know how he did this, but it was brilliant. He just knew me well enough. We developed a really, really nice friendship in our 2 years to this point in Seattle. And he said, "Hey, here you're not doing very well. That's understandable. But you know what? You need to get up here." And I go, "What do you mean, dude? I have nothing to offer. I'm 265 pounds. I'm completely depressed. I don't know what life has for me. You know, I don't know exactly words I say." He goes, "Get out of the pity party. It's awful what happened. It's beyond awful. And I'll never pretend to know the pain. But you have 52 guys up here that need you. And you have a coaching staff that needs you. And you have a team that needs you." And he said, "Get your butt to training camp." I said, "Bro, I can't come to training camp. I can't, you know, I couldn't go throw a football 10 yards. I couldn't walk across the driveway." He goes, "Get to training camp." And I hung up the phone and I went to my wife and I said, "Boy, I took some balls by Matt. But he's right. If you would release me, I think this is best for all of us." And she totally agreed. She's completely like mine. I've never asked, but I'm pretty sure her and Matt had talked in the process. Right. And sure enough, I went up there and was a shell of myself. And my teammates were incredible. Matt was amazing. I was still couldn't sleep. I'd be up late at night in the dorm room. We stay in these dorms. Matt would come over and knock on the door, and because he was in the dorm, he'd hear me crying or he'd hear me wrestling, moving around in the room, and he'd put on Sega Genesis 93 hockey and we'd play hockey, or we would throw darts, or we would play cards, or he would just until I'd fall asleep. And this is his first time really being a starting quarterback in the league. So he has everything to gain, everything to lose in this training camp. And yet what he was showing me was what being a great teammate was again, because he just cared about me.
Right.
And all the team, Robbie Toback, Steve Hutchinson, I mean, go on and on, Walter Jones, I can go on to every teammate on that team, Jeremy Urban, they were all so great. They never tried to pretend that they knew what I was going through, but they held me accountable to being a teammate. They pushed me when I was on that treadmill walking for an hour trying to lose 30 pounds. They'd hold me accountable in the training table when I couldn't eat what they were eating because I was fat pig and I was having to lose weight quickly. And over the course of 6 weeks or something, I got back, and football and that team and those guys and that coaching staff and our friends really pulled me out of that deep depression. And I mean, I don't think I've ever told that actual part of the story before, but again, learned so much just through that journey with those guys.
The darkness, when it creeps in, I certainly have had darkness that's crept into my life. I've never gone through something like you've gone through. What's interesting, though, is that that darkness is only relative to yourself. You only know how dark it is based on how dark it was previously.
Yeah.
So there's always that darkest moment.
Yeah.
Your darkness was far darker than my darkest moment. But we each have those dark moments. With time brings wisdom. Now that you can look back over the last 14 years, what's the wisdom that is set in that originated out of that darkness?
Ooh. Letting go. I think if I were, I have a bunch of book titles. I'll never write a book. Nobody cares. But if I were to, I have a bunch of book titles. One of them is letting go. Like you don't really experience life until you let go of it. And OCD people like me and control freaks, this is the hardest thing to do. I am such a control freak, obnoxiously so. My family, when they listen to this, will crack up because they just roll their eyes. But I've had to let go of so many things. And the greatest moments of my life are when I was able to actually let go. And what I mean, the wisdom I gained through Trevin is that they're not ours. You know, they're gifts. They're under our stewardship, but they're not ours. And if you wrap your whole life in your kid, you're setting yourself up for a massive fall. And when I realized that he's with his real daddy and I got 5.5 years with him and these other three beautiful girls that are just more than amazing, more than amazing, my three daughters. But I constantly remind myself that they're not mine, that I have to let go of their futures. I can be steward them. I can lead them. I can help set a path for them, be an example for them, love them unconditionally, but I have to let go. And it, that fits into so many things in life.
That idea of letting go, if you think about the universe and God and the way that it works, the greatest gift that we have obviously is life, but it's having a life that is free and we have free will. And when we step back and we look at the tragic events that happen in our life or in someone else's life, they happen because of free will.
Yeah.
They happen, and the lessons to be taken from those tragedies is that we're not in control.
Yeah.
The great master of the universe, God, however someone relates to it, there is a plan far beyond what we could possibly understand. And the lesson that we take out of tragedies is that we have to let go of this because we're not in control of them.
And when you do, you find peace. And I think that's the greatest quality I have in my life that has nothing to do with me. It's a gift, is the peace that I have, the peace that transcends understanding through the tragedies, but through the minor little bumps in the road, like today when I got fired. Right. I mean, there's just a peace that sustains me and those like-minded that understand that it's far greater than our comprehension. And when you do let go and when you do realize that, there's a peace that can't be explained. And I feel very lucky to have that.
When you look at the world today and you sort of feel the negative energy.
Yeah.
I, as an eternal optimist, am just baffled as to whether or not this negative energy is real or if it's just what I'm absorbing. Either way, I don't like it.
That's why we're such good buddies, because we're both glass not half full. We're like, it's dripping over the edges all the time full. Right. I feel the same way. For me, I just gave a talk the other night. And I was wrestling with a kind of a unique way to do it. And I focused on cheerleaders. And everybody like rolled their eyes. And I said, no, let's think about this. If we all had a personal cheerleader, how much better would life be? What if everybody decided to be a cheerleader for everybody else? What if we were all so concerned with rooting for the person next to us and looking to elevate others and looking to find the good and affirm the good? Then a lot of this negativity crap would go away. And I can't control that, but I'm going to choose to live the rest of my life as a cheerleader for others. I love it when people do it for me. Matthew Hasbeck would joke if he was here, or my wife would joke. The people who know me the best be like, yeah, I'm a words of affirmation guy. I love being encouraged. Is there anything wrong with that? I'll admit that. It feels good when people say good things about me. Now, I'm not devastated when I hear bad things about me, but when I hear good things, it makes me feel good. Well, I think most people are wired that way.
Right.
So let's make a point to say good things about people around us. And I know I'm going to live my life that way. Today, getting fired, my boss, who I love, Seth Markman, I'll put him on this podcast. Seth's been a great friend, a great boss. He had to call me and fire me today. And I immediately switched it to, dude, hey, not a big deal. I want this to be the easiest call you have. I'm at peace with it. I get it. I'm sad, but oh well. Hey, and I started trying to cheer him on and tell him what a great job he's done. His team's going to be fine. And that's just how I roll. I mean, I'm going to roll that way until I'm in the dirt.
Right.
Because I think we need, I like it. And I think if I like it, other people like it too. I haven't found somebody yet that I haven't cheered for that disliked it.
You know, one thing that has emerged from the darkness in my life is that I have found myself far more sympathetic to other people, where a lot of people like to sit back and sort of people watch and almost mock people, like, oh, I can't believe what that person's wearing, or I can't believe how that person looks. I now sit back, having gone through my own dark moments, and I look at people and I say, I wonder how dark their darkness was. I wonder what the moment was that got them down, because they're not choosing to be like that right now. They just can't see. And I wonder, and I become incredibly sympathetic to those struggling people who are struggling in life. And I feel like we're all part of this fabric of, we're all struggling. It just depends on
Amen.
To what degree.
And how much we can fake it,
right.
how much we can hide the pain,
right.
How much we've quieted that inner voice or sequestered that inner voice because we don't want to hear what it has to say, which I still do. I'm not preaching because I still fall into those patterns constantly. Yep. You're so right. I have gained so much empathy through this. This political cycle was brutal. Seeing just the anger and the hatred, and especially during the election, but even post-election stuff. But I also can hurt for the people that are so angry. I think there's enough empathy there. When I see people, I see their pain a lot of times now, because I've had such great pain. I find it very hard to get angry at people today, because instead of anger, I feel sorrow.
Right.
To be honest with you, like, you know, the media, we're in the media and there's haters, and right. Every media member puts on this vest, haters gonna hate, and I don't hear the hate, and we all hear it, right? If you open your Twitter feed ever, right. you see the hate, every right. one of us, but I don't get angry at these people. I feel bad for them. And a genuine sorrow. Like, what gets somebody to sit there at 10 o'clock at night and randomly just tweet mean things to people?
Right. Like they meant to do it. Yeah, they didn't accidentally.
It's very intentional.
It.
And for me, I just, I kind of want to know the pain behind that.
Right.
Cause I went through a time, I skipped over a bunch of stuff in my story of Trevin. There were some angry, you know, bitter stuff that I saw a lot of ugliness come out. I still see patterns of ugliness that come out in me. And luckily I've learned how to listen to that inner voice that says, hey, dummy.
Yeah.
You know, this is ugly. This is gross.
Right.
This is nasty.
One of the things that I've learned about myself, and as much as I try to live as pure life as possible and try to be as good a person as possible, the older I get, the clearer I see the evil that men do. And I consciously say, you know what? I'm also part of that group. I need to make sure that I'm checking myself. And that's where having a great spouse, having a great family, having that support system is there to keep you in check.
Every stupid decision I make, and they're countless, it goes back to two things, pride and selfishness. I can trace back every single one. Right. Every evil thing I do comes back to my pride, and then the selfish ambition, the selfish desires, the just caring about me more than caring about everybody else.
I want to know now, after you've gone through all of this, when you lie down in bed,
yeah,
and it's in between that state of being asleep and being awake where you had your cottage cheese moment
yeah.
in college, what do you think about? What do you dream about now? What do you reflect on?
Well, number one thing that is constant, that is thankfulness. I find myself overwhelmed being thankful to my creator for everything, good, bad, indifferent. What excites me, you know, Michael Gervais tried to get me to write this in 20 words or less, and I still haven't found it the right way to do it. I love seeing people succeed. I love being part of teams. I love seeing a group of people come together and accomplish things they didn't think they could. I love to celebrate people. I love to see the best of people come out. That's why I'm passionate about the high school quarterback space and what I do with Elite 11, not because they're good quarterbacks and they can throw the ball well and they're going to get a full ride and they might play in the NFL. I like seeing them for the 10 days I'm around them be the best they've ever been.
Right.
Because I got the best coaches and we message them the right way and we bring the fullness. That I say this, every one of them's gotten worse since they've left us, even the ones that were the first pick in the draft.
Right.
Their greatest moments are the 10 days they're with us. Because that's our number one job. Our number one goal is to see the best in them, not find the weaknesses in them.
Right.
I love seeing ESPN, a new group of guys this year or last year, Charles Woodson, Randy Moss, and Matt Hasbeck, and myself working with Chris Berman in his last year. And he's with four dudes he's never worked a lot with. I mean, he's worked with me, but three other. And I see us coming together as a ragamuffin group in week one, and by the playoffs we're rolling and doing good TV and have come together and learned a lot about each other, and those three are going to be stars. Charles and Randy and Matt are going to be stars. I love seeing stuff like that. I love seeing my girls volleyball teams do things they didn't think they could do. I love seeing, we just had this great story, this high school girl that when my middle daughter started playing with her, I never thought in a million years she'd ever start a varsity game, let alone play in college. She just got a scholarship to play in college. And watching her grow for 4 years has just been amazing.
You love to see people succeed. Part of the way that you can do that is by supporting charities and foundations.
Yeah.
What are your top charities that you'd like our audience to consider supporting?
So we've changed our giving patterns a lot over the years. I believe firmly in the tithing principle. And we are, I believe, in going over and above that. I think what we've tried to do is obviously give to our local church. We try to give to the ministries that feed us or feed our loved ones the most. And now in the last 5, 6, 7 years, I've really looked at maximizing those gifts, that if you give X amount of dollars, that it's going to, the impact is going to be magnified. There's a ministry, JH Ranch, that very few people have heard about. It's a ranch up in Northern California that does daddy, daughter, mommy, son, couples retreats for a week, and you do extreme courses. And basically, you get uncomfortable for a week as a part with your partner. Your partner can be your kid or your wife, and you grow exponentially through. It's had a massive impact on my family, so we give to things like that. PAO, Professional Athletes Outreach, is a ministry that serves professional athletes and their spouses. It helps with their marriages, helps them understand their finances. Some of the best dudes in the NFL have been part of the PAO network forever. There's a lot of secular organizations we support because they do great boots on the ground type work in communities. We set up our personal foundation after Trevin. We call it TD4, the number 4, because that's the number I wore in Seattle. Him meaning the Lord. And we've just used it as a giving vehicle. So people give to it, and we give to things that would put a smile on Trevin's face. That's what we always say. And he loved people. That could be a community park. We could build a football stadium.
Or rescue some golden retrievers.
Exactly. So very broad in our giving, but the focus usually is on ministries that have had massive impacts in our lives or impacts on the lives of the people around us, or kind of secular organizations that service a lot of kids.
Sure. Give our audience advice on those who may not be able to recognize those brink of midnight moments that happen in their life. What do they need to do to see them more clearly?
Get quiet, take inventory, and be willing to listen to yourself. But you can't do it if you're not willing to get quiet. These devices that just went off in my pocket and that we have all over our homes, which are good. I'm not an anti-technology guy. There's a lot of good, but they don't ever let us get quiet. Find that happy place. It can be down by the stream. It can be on your front deck. For some people, it's in the middle of a city park where there is noise and chaos, but where you can get quiet in your own mind. Take inventory. I mean, it's pretty easy. Take inventory of the decisions you've made and where they've taken you.
Right.
And what you want to be. What you want to be in 30 years and what you can take to the grave and what you can't. But then the biggest thing is you have to be willing to listen. After that, actually listen to what's being said and then be moved to action by that little voice in your head.
for you over your life, have there been some songs that have been important to you that you go back to that you're like, you know what? This is a song that helps me when I need to be lifted up.
Yeah, there's one that probably nobody's heard of. We have really good friends with Jeremy and Jennifer Deibler, and they had a band, FFH, and they wrote a song, Holy to You, which is a song that's probably been in 99 when I was at the lake. That was the song I listened to in one of those Brink of Midnight moments. I'd say that's the first one that comes to my mind. The other one that I have fun with, and it's one of everybody's favorite songs, but to me it has even a deeper meaning, is Don't Stop Believing by Journey. I mean, like we all do, right? We all sing it on our air guitars in our kitchens with our kids. We're not unique to that, but we've done it a lot of times. But I also listen to the song often and just the message behind it. There is something to that positive attitude, always believing, never giving up, the resilience of something good is coming, and just the lyrics, don't stop believing.
Just don't stop, and that's the key. Trent, you and I could talk forever, and I can't wait to see what's next for you. I mean, it's all that I know is that the road is laid out in front of you. And it's going to go in such a positive direction because you emanate such positive energy. And to me, you were literally one of the first people I met in this sports business. And from the second I met you, I was like, this is one of the greatest people I've ever met in my life.
Well, I appreciate that, John. It's been a pleasure getting to know you and your friendship and doing this. This has been fun. This is a unique thing. I hope this gets a lot of traction because a lot of surface level stuff right now out there. Right. This is obviously a deep dive, and not everybody has the appetite for a deep dive, but I think everybody should have a little more of an appetite for it.
Well, thank you so much for being on the Brink of Midnight podcast, and God bless you, and cannot thank you enough for being such a great friend.
Oh, thanks, brother.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate all your support. You can find show notes at brinkofmidnight.com. For social, we're at Brink of Midnight, and you can follow me personally on Twitter at @JohnBrinkus_. Now look, I believe we all need to fill our lives with positive stories. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, and most importantly, leave us a review on iTunes. That review will help the most to shine the light on these incredible Brink of Midnight moments. Today's closing song is one of ours. It's called Bridge to Heaven by Brink of Midnight.